later with a baleful glare. "Do you doubt me, Norg?" Norg looked at his Mogur uncomfortably, but got no satisfaction from the magician's confused expression. "Norg, we have traveled far, and we are tired," Brunn said. "This is hardly the time to discuss it. Do you deny us the hospitality of your cave?" It was a tense moment. If Norg refused them, they would have no choice but to return the long distance back to their cave. It would be a grave breach of propriety, but to allow Aayla entrance would be tantamount to accepting her as a woman of the clan. At least it would give Brunn a clear edge. Norg looked again at his Mogur, then at the powerful one-eyed man who was the Mogur, then back at the man who was leader of the clan, ranked first of all the clans. If the Mogur said so, what could he do? Norg signaled his mate to show Brunn's clan to the place reserved for them, but he marched in beside Brunn and the Mogur. As soon as they were settled, he was going to find out how a woman obviously born to the others had become a woman of the clan. The entrance to the cave of the host clan was smaller than the entrance to the cave of Brunn's clan, and the cave itself seemed smaller when they first walked in. But rather than one large room with a small adjunct for ceremonies, this cave was a series of rooms and tunnels that honeycombed their way far into the mountain, most of them unexplored. There was more than enough room to house all the visiting clans, though they might not have the advantage of light from the mouth. Brunn's clan was led to the room second from the front and filled one whole side of it. It was a favorable location, befitting their top-ranked status. Though several clans were already settled farther back, the place would have been held for them until the beginning of the actual Bear Festival. Only then, when it was certain they weren't coming, would it be given to the next highest-ranked clan. The clan as a whole had no leader, but there was a hierarchy of clans, just as there was a hierarchy of members within a clan. And the leader of the highest-ranked clan became, in effect, the leader of the clan, simply because he was the highest-ranking member. But it was by no means a position of absolute authority. The clans were too autonomous for that. All were led by independent, dictatorial men who were accustomed to being a law unto themselves, meeting only once in 7 years. They did not yield easily to greater authority save tradition and the world of the spirits. The way each clan fit in the hierarchy, and therefore the one man acknowledged leader of the clan, was decided at the clan gathering. Many elements contributed to a clan's status. Ceremonies were not the only activity. Competitions were of equal, if not greater, importance. The necessity of cooperation within clans for survival, which imposed the stricture of self-control, found an acceptable outlet in contests with other clans, and it was as necessary for survival in a different way. Controlled competition kept them from each other's throats. Nearly everything became a competition when the clans met. The men vied in wrestling, sling hurling, bola throwing, arm strength with use of a club, running, more complicated running and spear-stabbing races, tool-making, dancing, storytelling, and the combination of both in dramatic hunt reenactments. Though theirs were not given as much weight as the men's competitions, the women made their contribution. The great feast was an opportunity to display cooking skills. The gifts brought for the host clan were first arranged in plain view for everyone's inspection, critically examined, and judged by a consensus of the other women. The handiwork included soft, pliable skins, luxuriant furs, watertight baskets, open-weave carrying baskets, mats of subtle texture and design, containers of stiff rawhide or bark, strong cords of sinew or fibrous plants or animal hair, long thongs of even width with no weak spots, wooden bowls finished to a uniform smoothness, serving platters of bone or the thinner sections of logs, cups, bowls and ladles, hoods, hats, foot coverings, hand coverings, and other pouches. Even babies were compared. The honors were not awarded as obviously among the women. Theirs was a more subtle game of differences in expression or gesture or posture that discriminated with finesse, but it was no less honest in perceptively distinguishing mediocre from good work and awarding approbation to that which was truly fine. The relative position of each clan's medicine woman and Mogur was a consideration in determining status. Issa and Kreb had both contributed to the first place of Brunn's clan, as did the fact that the clan had been first for several generations before him, only, however, giving Brunn a slight edge when he first became leader. As important as all the contributing factors were, it was the leadership capability of the head of the clan that was decisive. And if the competition among the women was subtle, the determination of which leader was most capable was infinitely more so. Partly, the determination depended on how well the men of each clan performed in the competitions, showing how well a leader trained and motivated them. Partly, on how hard the women worked and how well they conducted themselves, showing a leader's firm guiding hand. Part was based on adherence to clan tradition. But most of a leader's position, and consequently his clan's, was based on the strength of his own character. Brunn knew he would be pushed to the limit this time. He had already lost ground by bringing Ayla. Clan gatherings were also a time to reestablish old acquaintances, see relatives from other clans, and exchange gossip and stories that would enliven many a cold winter evening for the next few years. Young people, unable to find mates within their own clan, vied for each other's attention, though matings could only take place if the woman was acceptable to the leader of the young man's clan. It was considered an honor for a young woman to be chosen, especially by a clan of a higher status, although moving away would be traumatic for her and her loved ones left behind. Despite Zaug's recommendation and the status of Issa's line, Issa thought it was doubtful that Ayla would find a mate. Having a child might have helped if her son had been normal, but her deformed baby precluded any hope for her. Ayla's thoughts were far from finding a mate. She was having enough trouble just getting up courage to face the congregation of curious, suspicious people outside the cave. She and Uba had unpacked and set up the hearth that would be their home for the duration of their visit. Norg's mate had seen to it that stones for fireplaces and definition of boundaries were piled conveniently nearby, and skins of water were available for guest clans. Ayla had taken great care to display her gifts for the host clan the way Issa had explained, and the quality of her work had already attracted notice. She washed off the travel grime, changed to a clean wrap, then nursed her son while Uba waited impatiently. The girl was anxious to explore the area near the cave and see all the people, but reluctant to face them alone.
"Hurry, Ayla," she motioned. "Everyone else is out already. Can't you feed Dirk later? I'd rather sit out in the sun than in this dark old cave, wouldn't you?"
"I don't want him to start crying right away. You know how loud he cries. People might think I'm not a good mother," Ayla said. "I don't want to do anything to make them think any worse of me than they do. Kreb told me people would be surprised when they saw me, but I didn't think they might not let us stay. And I didn't think they'd stare like that."
This is the end of disc number 13. Please insert disc number 14. This is disc number 14.
Kreb told me people would be surprised when they saw me, but I didn't think they might not let us stay, and I didn't think they'd stare like that.
"Well, they let us in, and after Kreb and Brunn get through talking to them, they'll know you're a clan woman. Come on, Ayla. You can't stay in the cave forever. You've got to face them sooner or later. They'll get used to you after a while, just like we did. I don't notice that you look different, hardly at all. I really have to think about it.
I was there before you were born, Uba. They've never seen me before." "Oh, all right. I might as well get it over with. Let's go. Don't forget to bring something for the cave bear to eat." Ayla got up, leaned Dirk against her shoulder, and patted his back as they started out. They made a gesture of respect to Norg's mate as they passed her hearth. The woman returned a greeting gesture and quickly turned back to her task, suddenly conscious that she had been staring. Ayla took a deep breath as she neared the entrance and held her head up a little higher. She was determined to ignore the curiosity about her. She was a woman of the clan, and she belonged here as much as anyone. Her determination was tested to the fullest when she walked into the bright sunlight. Every person of every clan had found some reason to stay near the cave to wait for the strange clan woman to come out. Many of them tried not to be obvious about it, but many more forgot or ignored common courtesy and stared in open-mouthed wonder. Ayla could feel her face flush. she changed Dirk's position as an excuse to look at him rather than the multitude of faces turned in her direction. It was fortunate she was looking at her son. Her action focused attention on Dirk, who had been overlooked at the first shock of her appearance. Expressions and gestures, some not so discreet, made it clear what they thought of her son. He would not have had to look like one of their babies. If he resembled her, they could have accepted him better. Regardless of what Brunn and the Mogur said, Ayla was one of the others. Her baby could have fit into the same mold. But Dirk had enough clan characteristics to make his modifications seem to be distortions. He was a grossly deformed baby that should not have been allowed to live. Not only did Ayla's worth drop, Brunn lost more ground, too. Ayla turned her back on the suspicious stares and gaping mouths, and she and Duba went to look at the cave bear in his cage. When he saw them approach, the huge Bruin lumbered over, sat up, and reached through the bars of the cage for the expected treat. They both backed off at the sight of the monstrous paw with its thick, rather stubby claws, more adapted to digging the roots and tubers that made up a large part of his normal diet than to hauling his huge bulk up trees. Unlike brown bears, only the cubs of cave bears were agile and small enough to climb. Ayla and Duba put their apples on the ground just beyond the stout poles that had once been reasonably mature trees. The creature, raised like a well-loved child and never allowed the least bit of hunger, was entirely tame and comfortable around people. The intelligent animal had learned that certain actions invariably brought additional choice tidbits. He sat up and begged. Ayla would have smiled at his clownish antics if she had not remembered to control it in time. "Now I know why clans say their cave bears talk," Ayla motioned to Uba. "He's asking for more. Do you have another apple?" Uba gave her one of the small, hard, round fruits, and this time Ayla went to the cage and gave it to him. He put it in his mouth, then moved closer to the bars and rubbed his huge, shaggy head against a projection on one of the tree trunks. "I think you want to be scratched, you old honey lover," Ayla gestured. She had been warned never to motion bear or cave bear or Ursus in his presence. If he was called by his real names, he would remember who he was and know he was not just a member of the clan who raised him. It would make him a wild bear again, void the bear ceremony, and ruin the whole reason for the festival. She scratched behind his ear. "You like that, don't you, winter sleeper?" Ayla motioned and reached to scratch behind the other ear he had turned in her direction. "You could scratch your own ears if you wanted to. You're just lazy. Or do you want attention, you big furry baby?" Ayla rubbed and scratched the huge head, but when Dirk reached for a handful of shaggy hair, she backed away. She had petted and scratched the small wounded animal she had brought to their own cave enough to sense that this was just a bigger, tamer variety of the same thing. Protected by the heavy cage, she quickly lost her fear of the bear. But her baby was another matter. When Dirk reached his tiny hands for a fistful of hair, the huge mouth and long claws suddenly looked dangerous. "How could you get so close to him?" Uba motioned with awe. "I'd be afraid to get that close to his cage. He's really just a big baby. But I forgot about Dirk. That animal could hurt him with a friendly nudge. He may seem like a baby when he's begging for food or wants attention, but I'd hate to think what he could do if he ever got angry," Ayla said as they walked away from his cage. Uba wasn't the only one surprised at Ayla's fearlessness. The whole clan had been watching. Most visitors shied away, especially at first. Young boys made a game of dashing up, reaching in the cage, and touching the bear to show off their bravery. And men were too proud to show fear, whether they felt it or not. But few women outside the host clan ever went very close, and to reach through the bars to scratch him at first look was unexpected from a woman. It didn't exactly change their opinion of Ayla, but it made them wonder. Now that they had all gotten a good look at Ayla, people were drifting away, but she was still conscious of surreptitious glances. The outright stares from small children didn't bother her nearly as much. Theirs was the natural curiosity of the young for anything unusual, and didn't carry connotations of suspicion or disapproval. Ayla and Uba headed for a shady spot under an overhanging rock on the outer fringes of the large, sloping, cleared area in front of the cave. From that discreet distance, they could watch the activities without discourtesy. There had always been a closeness of a special quality between Ayla and Uba. Ayla had been sister, mother, and playmate to the younger girl. But since Uba had begun training in earnest, and especially after she followed Ayla to the small cave, their friendship shifted to a more equal relationship. They were close friends. Uba was almost 6 and had reached an age where she was beginning to show an interest in the opposite sex. They sat in the cool shade, Dirk lying on his stomach on top of the carrying cloak between them, kicking and waving his arms and lifting his head up to look around. During the trip, he had begun to babble and make cooing noises, which no clan baby ever did. It worried Ayla, yet in some inexplicable way, pleased her. Uba commented on the older boys and young men, and Ayla teased her about it in a friendly way. By unspoken agreement, no mention was made of possible mates for Ayla, though she was of a far more mateable age. They were both glad the long journey was over, and speculated about the bear ceremony, since neither had been to a clan gathering before. While they talked, a young woman approached, and in the formal, silent, universally known language, shyly asked if she could join them. They welcomed her. It was the first friendly gesture they had received. They could see she had a baby in her carrying cloak, but it was sleeping, and the woman made no move to disturb it. "This woman is called Oda," she motioned formally after she sat down, and made a gesture that indicated she wanted to know their names. Uba responded, "This girl is called Uba. The woman is Ayla."
"A-A-ga. Name word not know."
Oda's common dialect and gestures were a little different, but they understood the essence of her comment. "The name is not clan," the blonde woman said. She understood the difficulty the rest of them had with her name. Even some in her own clan could not say it quite right. Oda nodded, lifted her hands as though she was going to say something, then changed her mind. She seemed nervous and uncomfortable. Finally, she motioned toward Dirk.
"This woman can see you have an infant," she said rather hesitantly. "Is the infant a male or a female?"
"The infant is a male. The infant's name is Dirk, like Dirk of the legend. Is the woman familiar with that legend?" Oda's eyes had a strange look of relief.
"This woman knows of the legend. The name is not common with this woman's clan."
"The name is not common with this woman's clan either, but the infant is not common. Dirk is special. The name is suitable," Ayla motioned with a hint of proud defiance.
"This woman has an infant. The infant is female. The name is Yura," Oda said.
She still seemed nervous and hesitant. A strained silence followed. "Does the infant sleep?" "This woman would see Yura if the mother would allow," Ayla finally asked, not knowing what else to say to the woman whose friendliness had such a hesitant quality. Oda seemed to consider the request for a while, then, as though making a decision, took the baby from her cloak and laid her in Ayla's arms. Ayla's eyes flew open in stunned amazement. Yura was young. She could not have been born much more than a moon before, but it wasn't the newborn look that surprised the tall woman. Yura looked like Dirk. She looked enough like Dirk to be his sibling. Oda's baby could have been hers. Ayla's mind reeled with the impact. How could a clan woman have a baby that resembled hers? She thought Dirk looked different because he was part clan and part her, but Kreb and Brunn must have been right all along. Dirk wasn't different. He was deformed, just like Oda's baby was deformed. Ayla was at a loss. She was so upset, she couldn't think of anything to say. Uba finally broke the long silence.
"Your baby looks like Dirk, Oda."
Uba forgot to use the formal language, but Oda understood her.
"Yes," the woman nodded. "This woman was surprised when she saw Aga's baby. That's why this woman wanted to talk to you. I didn't know if yours was a boy or a girl, but I hoped the infant would be male."
"Why?"
Ayla signaled. Oda looked at the baby in Ayla's lap.
"My daughter is deformed," she gestured, without quite looking at Ayla. "I was afraid she would never find a mate when she grows up. What man would have such a deformed woman?"
Oda's eyes pleaded when she looked at Ayla.
When this woman saw your infant, I hoped he was male because it will not be easy for your son to find a mate either, you know."
Ayla hadn't thought about a mate for Dirk. Oda was right. He might have trouble finding a woman to mate. She understood now why Oda had approached them.
"Is your daughter healthy?" she asked. "Strong?"
Oda looked at her hands before she answered. The infant is thin, but the health is good. The infant has a weak neck, she gestured, but it's getting stronger, Oda added fervently. Ayla looked more closely at the baby girl, asking permission with a questioning look before removing her swaddling. The infant was more stocky than Dirk, closer to the build of clan babies, but her bones were thinner. She had the same high forehead and general shape to her head, only the brow ridges were much smaller. Her nose was almost petite, but it was clear she would have the prognathous chinless jaw of the clan. The female baby's neck was shorter than Dirk's, but definitely longer than normal for clan babies. Ayla lifted the girl, automatically supporting her head, and saw the familiar early efforts of the baby to support her own head. Her neck will get stronger, Oda. Dirk's was even weaker when he was born, and look at him now. Do you think so? Oda answered eagerly. This woman would ask the medicine woman of the first clan to consider this female infant as mate for her male infant, Oda asked formally. I think Yura would make a good mate for Dirk, Oda. Then you'll ask your mate if he will allow it? I have no mate, Ayla replied. Oh, then your son is unlucky, Oda gestured with disappointment. Who will train him if you are not mated? Dirk is not unlucky, Ayla insisted. Not all babies born to unmated women are unlucky. I live at the Mogur's hearth. He does not hunt, but Brunn himself has promised to train my son. He will be a good hunter and a good provider. He has a hunting totem, too. The Mogur said it is the gray wolf. It doesn't matter. An unlucky mate would be better than no mate at all, Oda motioned with resignation. I hope you're right. Our Mogur has not revealed Yura's totem yet, but a gray wolf is strong enough for any woman's totem. Except Ayla's, Ube interjected. Her totem is the cave lion. She was chosen. How did you ever have a baby? Oda asked with astonishment. Mine is the hamster, but he really fought hard this time. I didn't have so much trouble with my first daughter. My pregnancy was hard, too. Do you have another daughter? Is she normal? She was. She walks in the next world now, Oda motioned sadly. Is that why Yura was allowed to live? I'm surprised you were allowed to keep her, Ayla remarked. I didn't want to keep her, but my mate made me. It's my punishment, Oda confessed. Your punishment? Yes, Oda nodded. I wished for a girl when my mate wanted a boy. It's just that I loved my first baby so much. When she was killed, I wanted another girl just like her. My mate says Yura is deformed because I had the wrong thoughts when I was pregnant. He says if I had wished for a boy, my baby would have been normal. He made me keep her so everyone would know I am not a good woman. But he didn't give me away, maybe because no one else would have me. I don't think you're such a bad woman, Oda, Ayla gestured with a look of compassion. Issa wished for a girl when she was carrying Uba. She told me she asked her totem for a girl every day. How did your first daughter die? She was killed by a man, Oda flushed with embarrassment. A man who looked like you, Aga. A man of the others. A man of the others, Ayla thought. A man who looks like me? She felt a chill crawl up her spine and a tingling at the roots of her hair. She noticed Oda's discomfiture. Issa says I was born to the others, Oda, but I don't remember anything about them. I am clan now, she said encouragingly. How did it happen? We were on a hunting trip. Two other women and me, besides the men. Our clan lives north of here, but that time we went farther north than we ever went before. The men left camp early. We stayed to collect wood and dried grass. There were lots of blowflies, and we knew we'd have to keep a fire going to get the meat dried. All of a sudden, these men ran into our camp. They wanted to relieve their needs with us, but they didn't make the signal. If they had made the signal, I would have assumed the position, but they didn't give me a chance. They just grabbed us and threw us down. They were so rough, they didn't even let me put my baby down first. The one who grabbed me tore off my wrap and my cloak. My baby fell, but he didn't notice. When he was through, Oda continued, another man was going to take me. But one of the other men saw my baby. He picked her up and gave her to me. But she was dead. She hit her head on a rock when she fell. Then the man who found her made many loud words, and they all left. When the hunters came back, we told them, and they took us back to the cave right away. My mate was good to me then. He grieved for my daughter, too. I was so glad when I found out my totem had been defeated again so soon after losing her. I didn't even have the woman's curse once. I thought my totem was sorry I lost my baby and decided to let me have another to make up for her. That's why I thought I might have another girl. But I shouldn't have wished for a girl. I'm sorry, Ayla said. I don't know what I'd do if I lost Dirk. I almost did once. I'll talk to the Mogur about Yura. I'm sure he will talk to Brunn. He's fond of my son. I think Brunn might agree, too. It would be easier than trying to find a woman of our clan to mate with a deformed man. This woman would be grateful to the medicine woman, and I promise to train her well, Aiga. She will be a good woman, not like her mother. Brunn's clan has the highest status. I think my mate will agree. If he knows there is a place for Yura with Brunn's clan, he might not be so angry with me. He's always telling me my daughter will be nothing but a burden and never have any status. And when Yura gets older, I can tell her she doesn't have to worry about finding a mate. It can be difficult for a woman if no man wants her, Otis said. I know, the tall blonde woman replied. I'll talk to the Mogur as soon as I can. After Oda left, Ayla was pensive and preoccupied. Uba sensed her need for quiet and didn't disturb her. Poor Oda. She was happy, had a good mate, and a normal baby. Then those men had to come and spoil everything. Why didn't they just make the signal? Couldn't they see Oda had a baby? Those men of the others, they're as bad as Braud. Worse. At least Braud would have let her put her baby down first. Men and their needs. Clan men, men of the others, they're all alike. As she mused, her mind kept going back to thoughts of the others. Men of the others. Men who look like me. Who are the others? Issa said I was born to them. Why don't I remember anything about others? I can't even remember what they look like. Where do they live? I wonder, how does a man of the others look? Ayla remembered the reflection of herself in the still pool near their cave and tried to imagine a man with her face. But when she thought of a man, the image of Braud came to her mind, and with a flash of insight, the confused jumble of ideas spinning around in her head fell into place. Men of the others, of course. Oda said one of them relieved his needs with her, and she didn't have the curse even once after that. Then she gave birth to Yura, just like Dirk was born after Braud relieved his needs with me. That man was of the others, and I was born to them. But Oda and Braud, they're both clan. Yura is not deformed any more than Dirk is. He's part me and part clan, and so is Yura. Or rather, she's part Oda and part that man who killed her baby. Then Braud did start Dirk with his organ, not the spirit of his totem. But the other women with Oda didn't have deformed babies, and as often as men and women do it, if a baby is started every time, there'd be nothing but babies. Maybe Kreb is right, too. A woman's totem has to be defeated, but she doesn't swallow the totem's essence. A man puts it inside her with his organ, and then it mixes up with the essence of a woman's totem. It's not just men, it's women, too. Why did it have to be Braud? I wanted a baby. My cave lion knew how much I wanted a baby. But Braud hates me. He hates Dirk, too. Who else would have? None of the other men are interested in me. I'm too ugly. Braud only did it because he knew how much I hated it. Did my cave lion know Braud's totem would finally win? His essence must be potent. Og already has two sons. Brock and Grev must have been started by Braud's organ too, like Dirk. Does that mean they're siblings? Brothers? Like Brunn and Kreb? Brunn must have started Braud inside Abra too, unless it was some other man. It could have been any man. Probably not, though. Men don't usually give the signal to the leader's mate. It's discourteous. And Braud doesn't like to share Oga. On the mammoth hunt, Krug always used Ovra. Everyone could see his need, and Guv was more considerate. Even Drug did once or twice. If Brunn started Braud, and Braud started Dirk, Does that mean Dirk is part of Brunn, too? And Brock? And Grev? Brunn and Kreb are siblings. They were born to the same mother and probably started by the same man. He was a leader, too. Does that mean Dirk is part of Kreb, too? And what about Isa? She's a sibling. Ayla shook her head. It's all too confusing, she thought. Braud did start Dirk, though. I wonder if my totem led Braud to give me the signal that first time. It was awful, but it could have been another test, and maybe there was no other way. My totem must have known, must have planned it. He knew how much I wanted a baby, and he did give me a sign that Dirk would live. Wouldn't it infuriate Braud if he knew? He hated me so much, he gave me the one thing I wanted most. Ayla, Uba said, interrupting her train of thought. I just saw Kreb and Brunn go into the cave. It's getting late. We should start preparing something to eat. Kreb will be hungry. Dirk had fallen asleep. He woke when Ayla picked him up, but soon settled back down, snuggled in the cloak next to his mother's breast. I'm sure Brunn will let Yura come and be Dirk's mate, she thought, as they walked back to the cave of the host clan. They are more right for each other than Oda realizes. But what about me? Will I ever find a mate that's right for me? Chapter 23. When the last two clans arrived, Ayla went through a similar ordeal, on a smaller scale, as the one that greeted her entrance. The tall blonde woman was an oddity among the nearly 250 clan people from 10 clans that had gathered together. She was noticed wherever she went, and her every action scrutinized. As abnormal as she appeared, no one could detect any deviation in her behavior. Ayla was extremely careful to make sure no one would. She displayed none of the peculiar characteristics that still slipped out in the more relaxed atmosphere of their own cave. She didn't laugh or even smile. No tears wet her eyes. No long strides or free-swinging arm movements betrayed her unwomanly inclinations. She was a paragon of clan virtue, an exemplary young matron, and no one noticed. No one outside her clan ever knew a woman who acted any other way. But it made her presence acceptable, and as Uba predicted, they got used to her. There were too many other activities at a meeting of the clans for the novelty of one strange woman to hold their attention for long. It wasn't easy to maintain such a large aggregation within the close confines of the cave environment for an extended period of time. It took cooperation, coordination, and a large dose of courtesy. The leaders of the 10 clans were far busier than they ever were with only their own members to worry about. The numbers of people added together multiplied the problems. Feeding the horde meant hunting expeditions had to be organized. While established patterns and ranks within any one clan made disposition of the hunters easy, when two or more clans hunted together, problems arose. Clan status determined the leader of the combined group, but which third-ranked man was more competent? They tried different arrangements at first, careful to exchange positions so no one would be offended. After the competition started, it would become easier. But no hunting party went out without first deciding the relative positions of the men. The women's plant-gathering forays had their problems, too. Theirs was a case of too many women trying to select the choicest produce. An area could be depleted quickly with no one getting quite enough. Preserved food brought with them supplemented the diet of every clan, but fresh foods were always more desirable. The host clan always foraged far away from their cave before a gathering. But even that courtesy was inadequate to satisfy the needs of all. Though no long journey limited their time to store food for winter, the clan that hosted the meeting still had to build up an extra reserve. By the time it was over, edible food plants in their vicinity would be exhausted. There was an adequate supply of water from the glacier-fed stream flowing nearby, but firewood was at a premium. Cooking was done outside the cave, unless it rained, and clans prepared their food as a unit rather than at separate hearths. Even so, most of the dried fallen deadwood and many living trees, which would take more than a season or two to replenish themselves, were used up. The environment around the cave after the clan gathering would never be the same. Supply was not the only problem. Disposal was an issue of equal importance. Human waste and other refuse had to be accommodated. and space had to be provided. Not only living space within the shelter of the cave, but space to cook, space to assemble, space for competitions and dancing and feasting, and space to move around. Organizing the activities was no small feat in itself. All of it involved interminable discussion and compromise within an atmosphere charged with intense competition. Custom and tradition played a large role in smoothing out many of the bumps, but it was in this arena that Brunn's administrative mind came to the fore. Kreb was not the only one whose enjoyment of the clan gathering was largely because of association with his peers. Brunn enjoyed the challenge of pitting himself against men whose authority equaled his own. That was his contest, to vie for domination of the other leaders. Interpretation of ancient ways sometimes required fine hair-splitting, the ability to make a decision, and the strength of character to hold to it, yet to know when to yield. Brunn was not first leader without reason. He knew when to be forceful, when to be conciliatory, when to call for a consensus, and when to stand alone. Whenever the clans gathered, one strong man usually emerged who could forge the authoritarian leaders into a cohesive, workable entity, at least for the duration of the meeting. Brunn was that man. He had been since he first became leader of his own clan. Had he lost face, his own self-doubt would have lost him his advantage. Without the base of surety in his own judgment, his diffidence would have cast doubt over his decisions. He could not face a gathering and the other leaders under those circumstances. But it was just that background of strength and compromise within the unyielding framework of clan tradition that had allowed him to make the concessions he had toward Ayla. And once the threat to himself was past, he began to view her differently. Ayla had tried to force a decision, but it was within the structure of clan custom as she interpreted it, and it wasn't in a wholly unworthy cause. True, she was a woman and must understand her place, but she had come to her senses and seen the error of her ways in time. When she showed him the location of her small cave, he was privately amazed that she had reached it in her weak condition. He wondered if a man could have done it, and masculinity was measured by stoic endurance. Brunn admired courage, determination, endurance. They showed strength of character. In spite of the fact that Ayla was a woman, Brunn admired her grit. "If Zaug were here, we would have won the sling competition," Krug motioned. "No one could have beaten him." "Except Ayla," Guv commented with guarded gestures. "Too bad she couldn't compete." "We don't need a woman to win," Brow gestured. "The sling contest doesn't count for that much anyway. Brunn will win the bowl of throwing. He always has. And there's still the spear and running contest." "But Vord already won the running competition. He stands a good chance to win in running and spear stabbing, too," Drug said. "And Gorn did well with the club." "Just wait until we show them our mammoth hunt. Our clan is bound to win," Brow answered. Hunt reenactments were a part of many ceremonies. Occasionally, they happened spontaneously, after an especially exciting hunt. Braud enjoyed acting them out. He knew he was good at evoking the sense of excitement and drama of the hunt, and loved being the center of attention. But hunt reenactments served a purpose greater than showing off. They were instructive. With expressive pantomime and a few props, they demonstrated hunting techniques and tactics to youngsters and other clans. It was a way of developing and sharing skills. Had they been asked, everyone would have agreed that the prize awarded to the clan that came out best in the complicated competition was status, to be acknowledged first among peers. But there was another prize awarded, though it was not acknowledged: the competition's sharpened skills necessary for survival. "We'll win if you lead the hunt dance, Braud," Borne said. The 10-year-old boy, fast approaching manhood, still idolized the future leader. Braud courted his adoration by admitting him into the men's discussions whenever he could. "Too bad your race doesn't count, Vorn. I was watching. It wasn't even close. You were way out in front. But it's good practice for next time," Braud said. Vorn glowed under the praise. "We've still got a good chance," Drug motioned. "But it could go the other way. Gorn is strong. He gave you a good fight in the wrestling match, Braud. I wasn't sure you could take him. Norg's second must be proud of the son of his mate. He's grown since the last gathering. I think he's the biggest man here."
He's got the strength all right, Goof said. It showed when he won with the club. But Braud is quicker and almost as strong. Gorn came in a close second. And Nauz is good with that sling. I think he must have seen Zaug last time and decided to work on it. He just didn't want to let an older man beat him again, Krug added. If he's practiced as much with the Bola, he may give Brunn a good contest. Bord is a fast runner, but I thought you were going to catch him, Braud. That one was close, too. You were just a step behind him. Drug makes the best tools, Grad gestured. The laconic man seldom volunteered comment. Selecting the best and bringing them here is one thing, Grad. But it will take luck to make them well with everyone watching. That young man from Norg's clan has skill, Drug replied. That's one contest where you'll have the advantage just because he is younger, Drug. He'll be more nervous, and you have more experience in competing. You'll be able to concentrate better, Uv encouraged. But it still takes luck. They all take luck, Krug said. I still think old Dorv tells a better story than anyone. You're just used to him, Krug, Uv motioned. That's a hard competition to judge. Even some of the women tell a good story. But not as exciting as the hunt dances. I think I saw Norg's clan talking about how they hunted a rhino, but they stopped when they saw me, Krug said. They may show that hunt. Oga approached the men diffidently and signaled that their evening meal was ready. They waved her off. She hoped it wouldn't take them too long to decide to come and eat. The longer they waited, the longer it would delay them from joining the other women who were gathering to tell stories, and she didn't want to miss any of it. Usually, it was the older women who acted out the legends and histories of the clan with dramatic pantomime. Often the stories were intended to educate the young, but they were all entertaining, sad stories that wrung the heart, happy stories that brought joy and inspiration, and humorous stories that made their own embarrassing moments feel less ridiculous. Oga went back to the fireplace near the cave. I don't think they're hungry yet, she motioned. It looks like they're coming after all, Ovra said. I hope they don't linger too long over the meal. Brun's coming, too. The leaders' meeting must be over. But I don't know where Mogur is, Abra added. He went into the cave with the Mogurs earlier. They must be in this clan's place of spirits. No telling when they'll be out. Do we have to wait for him? Uka asked. I'll set something aside for him, Ayla said. He always forgets to eat when he's getting ready for ceremonies. He's so used to eating his food cold, sometimes I think he likes it better. I don't think he'll mind if we don't wait for him. Look, they're starting already. We're going to miss the first stories, Ona gestured with disappointment. It can't be helped, Ona, Aga said. We can't go until the men are through. We won't miss too many, Ona, Ika consoled. The stories will go on all night, and tomorrow the men will show their best hunts, and we'll be allowed to watch. Won't that be exciting?
I'd rather watch the women's stories, Ona said.
Braud says our clan is going to do the mammoth hunt. He thinks we're sure to win. Brunn is going to let him lead it, Oga gestured, her eyes glowing with pride.
That will be exciting, Ona. I remember when Braud became a man and led the hunt dance. I couldn't even talk yet or understand anyone. But it was still exciting, Ayla motioned.
After the meal was served, the women waited anxiously, casting longing glances at the congregation of women gathered at the far end of the clearing. Abra, go ahead and watch your stories. We have things to discuss anyway, Brunn gestured. The women picked up babies and herded young children toward the group seated around an old woman who had just started a new story. And the mother of Great Ice Mountain.
Hurry, Ayla motioned. She's telling the legend of Dirk. I don't want to miss any of it. It's my favorite.
Everyone knows that, Ayla, Abra said.
The women of Brunn's clan found places to sit and were soon caught up in the tale. She tells it a little differently, Ayla motioned after a while.
Every clan's version is a little different, and every storyteller has his own way. But it's the same story. You're just used to Dorv. He's a man. He understands men's parts better. A woman tells more about the mothers, not only the mother of Great Ice Mountain, but how sad the mothers of Dirk and the other young people were when they left the clan, Uka answered. Ayla remembered that Uka had lost her son during the earthquake. The woman could understand a mother's sadness at losing her son. The modified version gave the legend a new meaning to Ayla, too. For a moment, her brow furrowed with concern.
My son's name is Dirk. I hope that doesn't mean I'll lose him someday. Ayla hugged her baby. No, it can't be. I almost lost him once. The danger is over now, isn't it? A stray breeze stirred a few loose tendrils of his hair, cooling for a moment his sweat-beaded brow as Brunn carefully gauged the distance to the stump of a tree near the edge of the cleared space that fronted the cave. The rest of the tree, sheared of branches, formed part of the palisade that surrounded the cave bear. The whiff of air only teased. It brought no respite from the stifling afternoon sun glaring down on the dusty field. But the ethereal zephyr moved more than the tensely watching throng that lined the periphery. Brunn was as still as they, standing with feet apart, his right arm hanging down at his side, grasping the handle of his bola. The three heavy stone balls, wrapped in leather shrunk to fit and attached to braided thongs of unequal length, were splayed out on the ground. Brunn wanted to win this contest, not only for the sake of the competition, though that too was important, but because he needed to show the other leaders he hadn't lost his competitive edge. Bringing Ayla to the clan gathering had cost him. He realized now that he and his clan had become too accustomed to her. She was too great an anomaly for the others to accept in so short a time. Even the Mogur was fighting to maintain his place, and he hadn't been able to convince the rest of the Mogurs that she was a medicine woman of Issa's line. They were willing to forego the special drink made from the roots rather than allow her to make it. The loss of Issa's status was one more support knocked out from under Brunn's crumbling position. If his clan came in less than first in the competitions, he was certain to lose status, and though they were in the running, the outcome was far from assured. But even winning the competition wouldn't guarantee his clan top rank. It would only give him an even chance. There were too many other variables. The clan that hosted the gathering always had an edge, and it was Norg's clan that was giving his the stiffest competition. If they ran a close enough second, it might give Norg enough backing to come out on top. Norg knew it, and was his most relentless opponent. Brunn was holding his own by sheer force of will. Brunn squinted as he eyed the stump. The movement, barely discernible, was enough to halt the breath of half the watchers. The next instant, the still figure became a blur of motion, and the three stone balls, whirling around their center, flew toward the stump. Brunn knew the moment the bola left his hand that his throw was off. The stones hit the target, then bounced away, failing to wrap around it. Brunn walked over to pick up his bola while Nauz took over his place. If Nauz missed the target entirely, Brunn would win. If he hit the stump, they would each have a second try. But if Nauz wrapped his bola around it, the match would be his. Brunn stood off on the sidelines, face impassive, resisting the urge to clutch his amulet, and only sent a mental plea to his totem. Nauz had no such compunctions. He reached for the small leather pouch around his neck, closed his eyes, then sighted the post. With a sudden burst of rapid motion, he let the bola fly. Only long years of firm self-control kept Brunn from letting his disappointment show when the bola wrapped around the stump and held. Nauz had won, and Brunn felt his position slip even more. Brunn stayed in his place while three hides were brought onto the field. One was lashed to the rotted stump of an old snag, a huge old tree whose jagged, broken top was a little taller than the men. Another was laid over a moss-covered fallen log of respectable proportions near the edge of the woods and held down with stones. And the third was spread out on the ground and again held in place with stones. The three formed a triangle of more or less equal sides. Each clan chose one man to compete in this contest, and they lined up in order of clan status near the hide spread on the ground. Other men, carrying sharpened spears, mostly made of yew, though birch, aspen, and willow were also used, went to the other targets. Two young men from among the lower-ranked clans paired up first. Each holding a spear, they waited tensely, side by side, eyes glued on Norg. At his signal, they made a dash for the upright snag and slammed their spears into it through the leather, aiming for the place where the animal's heart would be if the hide still covered him, then grabbed a second spear from their clansman waiting beside the target. They sprinted to the fallen log and jammed the second spear into it. By the time the third spear was snatched, one man was clearly in the lead. He ran back to the hide on the ground, thrust the spear deep as close to the middle as he could, then raised his arms triumphantly. After the first heat, 5 men were left. 3 of them lined up for the second race, this time from the highest-ranking clans. The one who came in last was given another chance against the remaining 2. Then the 2 men who came in second were paired up, leaving a field of 3 for the final race, the 2 first-place winners and the winner of the preceding race. The finalists were Braud, Vord, and the man from Norg's clan, Gorn. Of the 3, Gorn had run 4 races to earn his place in the finals, while the other 2 were fairly fresh after only 2. Gorn had won the first paired heat, but came in 3rd when the 3 highest-ranked clans raced. He ran again with the last 2 men and came in 2nd, then paired off with the man who had come in 2nd in the race where he ran 3rd, this time beating him. By sheer guts and stamina, Gorn had made it to the finals and had won the admiration of everyone there. When the 3 men lined up for the last race, Brunn stepped out on the field. "Norg," he said, "I think it would make the last race more fair if we delayed it to give Gorn a chance to rest. I think the son of the mate of your second in command deserves it." There were nods of approval, and Brunn's standing inched up, though Braud scowled. The suggestion put his own clan in a less competitive position. It took away the edge Braud might have in racing against a man already tired. But it showed Brunn's fairness, and Norg could hardly refuse. Brunn had quickly weighed the alternatives. If Braud lost, his clan stood to lose their position. But if Braud won, Brunn's evident fairness would boost his prestige, and it gave the impression of confidence he didn't altogether feel. It would make the win clean. There could be no question that Gorn might have won if he had been fresher, providing Braud won. And it was more fair. It was late in the afternoon before everyone gathered around the field again. Tensions held in abeyance were revived, and more. The 3 young men, all rested now, pranced around stretching muscles and hefting spears to find the right balance. Goof moved to the snag with 2 men from the other clans, and Krook went to the fallen log with 2 others. Braud, Gorn, and Vord lined up 3 abreast, fastened their eyes on Norg, and waited for his signal. The leader of the host clan lifted his arm. He dropped it quickly, and the men were off. Vord sprang to the lead with Braud at his heels and Gorn pounding hard behind. Vord was already reaching for his second spear as Braud rammed his into the rotted snag. Gorn put on a fresh burst of speed that urged Braud forward as they raced for the fallen log, but Vord was still ahead. He jabbed his spear into the hide-covered log just as Braud pulled up, but he hit a hidden gnarl and the spear clattered to the ground. By the time he retrieved it and thrust again, both Braud and Gorn had passed him by. He grabbed for his 3rd spear and set out after them, but for Vord, the race was lost. Braud and Gorn raced for the final target, legs pumping, hearts pounding. Gorn started gaining on Braud, then inched out ahead, but the sight of the broad-shouldered giant of a man making Braud eat his dust enraged him. He thought his lungs would burst as he surged forward, forcing every muscle and sinew. Gorn reached the hide spread on the ground an instant before Braud, but as he raised his arm, Braud darted beneath and planted his spear into the ground through the tough leather as he ran across the hide. Gorn's spear bit through at the next heartbeat. It was a heartbeat too late. As Braud slowed to a stop, the hunters of Brunn's clan crowded around him. Brunn watched them, his eyes glowing with pride. His heart was beating almost as fast as Braud's. He had agonized every step of the way with the son of his mate. It was close. For a few tense moments, Brunn was sure he was going to lose, but he had given his all and come through. It was a crucial race, but with this win, he had more than a chance. "I must be getting old," Brunn thought. "I lost the bola throw, but not Braud. Braud won. Maybe it's time to turn the clan over to him. I could make him leader, announce it right here. I'll fight for the first rank and let him go home with the honor. After that race, he deserves it. I'll do it. I'll tell him right now." Brunn waited until the men were through congratulating him, then approached the young man, looking forward to Braud's joy when he found out the great honor he was about to receive. It would be a fitting reward for the fine race he had run. It was the greatest gift he could give to the son of his mate. "Brunn," Braud saw the leader and spoke first. "Why did you have to delay the race? I almost lost. I could have beat him easily if you hadn't given him time to rest.
Don't you care if our clan is first? He motioned petulantly. Or is it that you know you'll be too old to be leader next gathering? If I'm going to be the leader, the least you could do is let me start as first, like you did. Brunn stepped back, stunned by Braud's vituperative attack. He struggled to control his conflicting emotions. You don't understand, Brunn thought. I wonder if you will ever understand. This clan is first. If I can help it, it will stay first. But what will happen when you become leader, Braud? How long will this clan be first then? The pride left his eyes, and a great sorrow overwhelmed him. But Brunn controlled that, too. Perhaps he's just too young, he rationalized. Maybe he just needs a little more time, a little more experience. Have I ever really explained? Brunn tried to forget that no one had to explain to him. Braud, if Gorn had been tired, would your win have been as good? What if the other clans doubted that you could beat him if he hadn't been tired? This way, they know for sure that you won, and so do you. You did well, son of my mate, Brunn motioned gently. You ran a good race. In spite of his bitterness, Braud still respected this man more than anyone he ever knew, and he could not help but respond. At that moment, Braud felt, as he had on his first manhood hunt, that he would give anything for such praise from Brunn. I didn't think about that, Brunn. You're right. This way everyone knows I won. They know I'm better than Gorn. With this race, and Drug winning the tool-making competition, if our mammoth hunt wins tonight, we're sure to come out first, Krug said enthusiastically. And you will be one of those chosen for the bear ceremony, Braud. More men crowded around Braud to congratulate him as he walked back to the cave. Brunn watched him go, and then saw Gorn walking back too, surrounded by Norg's clan. An older man clapped his shoulder in a gesture of encouragement. Norg's second has a right to be proud of the son of his mate, Brunn thought. Braud may have won the race, but I'm not sure he's the better man. Brunn had only controlled his sorrow, not eliminated it, and though he struggled to bury it deeper, the pain would not die. Braud was still the son of his mate, the child of his heart. The men of Norg's clan are brave hunters, Drug admitted. It was a good plan, digging a hole in the path the rhinoceros takes to his drinking place and covering it with brush to hide it. Maybe we could try it sometime. It took courage to drive him back when he bolted. Rhinos can be more fierce than mammoths, and much more unpredictable. Norg's hunters told it well, too. But it still wasn't as good as our mammoth hunt, everyone agreed, Krug said. Gorn deserved to be one of the chosen, though. Almost every contest was between Braud and Gorn. For a while I was afraid we would not win the competitions this year. Norg's clan is a very close second. What do you think of the third choice, Grad? Bord did well, but I would have chosen Naus, Grad replied. I think Brunn preferred Naus, too. It was a hard choice, but I think Vord deserved it, Drug commented. We won't be seeing much of Gulv until after the festival, Krug said. Now that the competitions are over, the acolytes will be spending all their time with the Mogurs. I hope the women don't think that just because Braud and Gulv won't be eating with us tonight, they don't have to make as much. I'm going to eat well. There won't be anything else until the feast tomorrow. I don't think I'd want to eat if I were Braud, Drug said. It's a great honor to be chosen for the bear ceremony. But if he ever needed courage, Braud will need it in the morning. The first morning light found the cave empty. The women were already up working by firelight, and the rest couldn't sleep. The preliminary preparations for the feast had consumed days, but the work was nothing compared with the task ahead. Full daylight was upon them long before the glowing disk burst over the tops of the mountains, flooding the cave site with burning rays from a sun already high. Excitement was tangible, tension unbearable. With the competitions over, the men had nothing to do until the ceremonies, and they were restless. Their nervous agitation infected the older boys, and they in turn stirred up the rest of the youngsters, driving the busy women to distraction. Milling men and chasing children all got in their way. The turbulence subsided temporarily when the women served cakes of crushed millet mixed with water and baked on hot stones. The breakfast of bland biscuits was eaten with solemnity. They were reserved for this one day alone out of every 7 years, and except for nursing babies, were the only food anyone would eat until the feast.
The millet cakes were a token only and did little more than whet the appetite. By mid-morning, hunger, stimulated by delicious smells emanating from various fires, intensified the turmoil, raising excited